You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, why don't we go ahead and get started? My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings. And I'm very pleased to welcome you all here today for this program on the Japan upper house elections. And we are very pleased to see so many people interested in Japan. We're going to talk about various aspects of the election, the political side, the implications for the economy and economic policy, and then implications for security and constitutional revision. We have an excellent panel to help us do that. To my far left, only spatially, is Michael Theis.
You don't know.
who teaches in the political science department at UCLA. We're very pleased that he made the trip all the way across the country to the East Coast from what Californians, I think, call the best coast. To my immediate left is my colleague, Maria Solis, who's the Phil Knight Chair for Japan at Brookings. And she, along with our colleague, Jennifer Mason, have done all the hard work to put this program together. And then to my right is Mike Mochizuki, who needs no introduction to Brookings, because before he moved to GW, where he's been for some time, he was a senior fellow here. So it's nice to welcome him back. And I would like to thank Michael for providing the material for these really dandy charts here, which I hope you picked up at the door. So we're going to do this in a kind of informal way. I'll pose some questions to each of the panelists. Maybe there'll be a little bit of interaction, and then we'll throw it open to your questions. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about how the Japanese electoral system works, the results of this election, and what does it mean that the diet is no longer twisted?
Okay. This was an election for the upper house, the House of Councilors. The electoral system that I'm about to describe is actually less complicated than the one for the lower house, although they're now fairly similar. So there are 242 members now in the upper house, with half elect. They serve six-year terms, and half are elected every 3 years. So it's somewhat like our Senate, that not the whole body is elected at once, but it's different in that the half, each half, represent the entire country. So in the U.S., we have 33 senators every couple of years. So some states have elections, other states don't have elections. In Japan, every prefecture elects half of their total representation every 3 years. There are two ways to get elected. So there are districts and there's a national constituency. The districts are the prefectures. There are 47 electoral districts. And from those 47 districts, 73 members are elected. 31 of the districts are single-member districts. There's one representative elected every 3 years. And the others have 2, 3, 4, or 5 members, depending on population. Depending on population is sort of, in principle, there's still huge malapportionment. So Tokyo has 5 representatives. If it were really represented proportionally relative to, say, a place like Tottori, it would probably have 10 or 12, maybe even more than that. But that's the basic idea. So that's 73 people are elected that way, and then another 48 are elected from a national proportional representation constituency. So each voter gets 2 votes. You vote for a candidate in your district, and if it's a single-member district, the one who gets the most votes wins. If it's a 3-member district, the 3 who get the finish first, second, and third each get a seat. And in the PR, you can vote for a party, just choose a party, and parties get seats proportion or equal to the proportion of votes that they got. Or now, starting in 2001, I think, you can vote for a candidate within a party. And then that vote goes toward the party to figure out what the party's share is going to be, but then it also moves the candidate up within the party to determine if a party wins, say, 10 seats in the proportional representation tier, which 10 individuals actually get those 10 seats depend on the preference votes that voters cast for them individually. All right, so it's kind of complicated how it gets elected. So that's what just happened. And the big picture result you can see in these first couple of pictures. I made one and Jennifer made one. The LDP and its partner, Kometo, won a big majority of the seats available in this election and added to the seats that weren't up for election that were elected 3 years ago. Now they hold a majority in the upper house overall. We could talk about details in a minute, but the big story is that the government now of Shinzo Abe, the coalition between the LDP and the Kometo, control a majority in both houses of parliament. This is important because, as was a surprise to a lot of Japan scholars starting around 1989, but especially in 2007, the Japanese upper house is actually extremely powerful. It's one of the most powerful upper houses in the world among parliamentary systems. Only Italy, Australia, and, Italy and Australia are as powerful. Germany, on some matters, the upper house is as strong. The upper house in Japan can, its approval is required for all legislation other than the budget and treaties, and it doesn't have a formal say on the choice of prime minister. But for everything else, the upper house has to say yes, with a caveat that the lower house can override a veto if they can muster two-thirds. And history has treated us with a strange coincidence that for the first time in post-war history where the government has not controlled the upper house, they have controlled two-thirds of the lower house. And so they actually have been able to override some upper house vetoes. But now we're in a situation of the government has simple majority in the upper house, commanding majority in the lower house, and it seems like they ought to be able to get any legislation they want through.
Okay. Thanks very much. As a former staff member in our House of Representatives, I have a lot of very weedy questions, but that I will not ask. What's the sort of bottom line on this? How big did Prime Minister Abe and his party win? How firmly are they in control? For how long? It's my impression that the turnout was rather low. What's the significance of that?
In December 2012, the LDP won a big landslide election in the supposedly more important lower house. And I wrote, a lot of people wrote at the time, that they just got lucky. They fell backwards into that landslide majority. A combination of a whole bunch of things happening that were none of which was that they were popular. The opposition, the main thing is that the government at the time, the DPJ, the Democratic Party, just imploded, and the opposition splintered into a bunch of pieces. There was also a regionally strong party, the Japan Restoration Party of Hashimoto, who I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about today, that did very well in the Kansai, the Osaka region. And turnout declined dramatically. So basically what happened in December 2012 was that voters, one thing they knew was they wanted to reject the DPJ. 10 million more people than usual did that by staying home. Of the ones who turned out, very few switched their vote to the LDP. Many more switched their vote to some other party, but they didn't choose a single other party. They spread them out along several parties. So what happened was, in the single-member districts, the LDP was the only big party left. And so they just waltzed home with all of these easy wins where, with not even a very large percentage of the vote necessarily. The LDP in December 2012 won fewer votes than they won in 2009 when they got swept out of power. But because turnout was low and because the non-LDP votes were distributed among a bunch of parties, the LDP walked home with this huge majority. So there were a lot of people, including me, writing right after the December election saying they're not going to be able to repeat this because the opposition isn't going to be so stupid this time around. They're going to find a way to jointly endorse candidates, to not spread themselves so thin. And the LDP, if they're going to win a majority in the upper house election in July 2013, they're going to have to actually earn it. They're going to actually have to be more popular. They're going to actually have to have voters voting for them, not just being sort of schizophrenic about how they vote against them. That was mostly wrong. The LDP did do better in the upper house in 2013 than they did. They did improve. Their share of the proportional representation vote went up. Their share of votes in the single-member districts and in the multi-member districts went up relative to when this cohort was elected last time in 2007. So another of these charts kind of shows what's happening here. If you like tables, there's a table at the top, and I made a couple of things are highlighted. But you can see is that a small vote swing, this is one thing that Americans aren't particularly used to, because we use single-member districts. But our districts are so hopelessly gerrymandered, most of them in partisan ways, that it really takes a pretty big vote swing to change who wins an election in the United States. There are some districts that are marginal, but most are not. In most countries that use single-member districts, Britain is a really good example, a pretty small vote swing, if it's a nationwide vote swing, can lead to a huge swing in seats. So if a party goes from losing a bunch of seats, 51 to 49, to winning a bunch of seats, 51 to 49, it doesn't take a huge vote swing for that to happen. It just has to be pretty uniform. And you can have the parliament just shift wholesale from one side to the other. So that's what happens in single-member districts in Japan, and that's what happened in single-member districts in the upper house last week as well. It was actually a pretty decent vote swing. The LDP's vote share went up by 8%, but that meant that they won all but two of the single-member districts. If you look actually in the first two lines of that table, you see from 2007 to 2010, the LDP's vote share went up from 43% to 47%. It was a 4 percentage point vote swing in their favor, and that led to a seat swing from 21% to 79%. So just this little shift in votes makes for a huge landslide. That doesn't happen as well. It doesn't happen the same way in multi-member districts, where if you come in second, you come in third, you can still win a seat. In Tokyo, you come in fifth, you can still win a seat. And so you can see in the table or in the pictures that the LDP really didn't improve in the multi-member districts in this election. They went from their candidate finishing second in most of them to finishing first, but it doesn't matter whether you finish second or finish first, you get a seat. So the LDP really didn't gain in the multi-member districts. And then in their PR gain, where voters are really voting for a party, not for a candidate, there was a slight gain, but not a very big one. So the pie charts, I think, are kind of telling. Let me just interpret them for you. The top line is votes, the bottom line is seats. And then you see the different kinds of districts, single-member districts, two-member districts, or greater than two. The blue half circle there, that's the DPJ's loss in each of these district types. So I should have made the circles different sizes, too. But you can see in the single-member districts, the DPJ lost 31 percentage points in terms of their vote share. And then the top half shows how the DPJ's loss was sort of translated to gains by others. So the red is the LDP, and the green is everyone else. And so you can see votes are on top, seats are on the bottom. So if you look at seats at the bottom, the LDP was basically the only beneficiary of the DPJ doing badly in single-member districts. The LDP won all of those single-member districts, with the exception of two that independents won. In the two-member districts, the LDP gained nothing. All of the DPJ's losses translated into more seats for other little parties. And in the PR tier, the little parties took the lion's share of what the DPJ gave up. Right? So you can see that this big seat swing was really away from the DPJ, and vote swing was away from the DPJ. Turnout declined dramatically. That helps the LDP, it helps Kometo, and it helps the communists, because those are the three parties whose voters turn out rain or shine, especially Kometo and the communists. So low turnout always benefits them in a proportional type setting, because proportionally, their folks will make up more of the electorate. But then of the folks who did vote, again, the 52% of the eligible voters who voted, what you see is that everyone decided to abandon the DPJ, or a lot of people did, but then they went lots of different places, with the net being that mostly because of the single-member district, the distortions the single-member districts create between vote swings and seat swings, the LDP ended up with this huge number of seats.
But what I hear you saying is that this didn't represent a huge increase in popularity for the LDP.
No, some. As the PR vote share is probably the most sincere measure of right. How voters support parties. There's no strategic voting in terms of who has a chance to win. You just vote sincerely for your favorite party. So there was some improvement. Although it's interesting looking at the polls, I don't think I showed that, the expectations of votes before the elections, a couple months before the election, half of Japanese voters said they would vote LDP. And just as it got closer and closer, it started dropping into the 40s, and they ended up with something like 35%, 37% of the PR vote. So they are by far the most popular party, but way below half. And the other news is the day after the election, Kyoto came out with a poll showing that Abe's personal support and support for the cabinet had dropped by 12 points to its lowest point since he took office.
So did the LDP use its tried and true techniques for winning this victory, however one assesses it? And what does this say about the DPJ as a sort of important political force in Japan?
Tried and true techniques. If you're thinking about the stories of the old LDP before the lower house reform was elected, where it's all about personal voting and candidates, I would say the answer is no. There's some of that. But analyses of the last several lower house and upper house elections show that vote swings now have very little to do with candidates and much more to do with party. So more normal, I guess, in a sense, you could say that way. The DPJ, on the other hand, they won 17 seats overall. They had 44 up for election, so they really got clobbered. Of their 17, I think 8 of them were incumbents in districts who won, in multi-member districts who won. There were several districts the DPJ didn't even, where their incumbent retired, and they didn't even bother to nominate someone new. There were several, I have the number here somewhere, 6 or 7 people who were elected as DPJ candidates 6 years ago ran as incumbents this time, but not for the DPJ. They switched to other parties. Some of those were folks who left with Ozawa Ichiro when he defected from the party. Others left for other reasons. So the DPJ wasn't even really a national party this time in terms of its candidates, like it was the time before. So what it says about the DPJ, and this is, it's really a continuation of what happened in December in the lower house election, is they're bankrupt. The Ozawa defection happening right before the lower house election really hurt them, but he was hurting them even more when he was in the party by demonstrating that the party had no particular vision, no particular leadership, no particular organization. And they haven't been able, you would have thought that maybe kind of excising that boil would have allowed them to consolidate a little bit, but they don't have a clue. I was talking to Mireya right before, and it was astounding, the DPJ's campaign against Abenomics in this election. It was the party leader, basically the DPJ's platform was, well, I don't know, might not work. Could be risky. That was kind of their campaign. So, yeah, I should be gun-shy about making predictions at this point, but I don't see the DPJ coming back. I think if anyone's going to challenge the LDP, and the next election doesn't have to happen for another 3 years, it's going to have to be some reconsolidation, some reorganization of the opposition. And one of the exit polls, actually, I think 69% of people responding in a, I guess it was either a Yomiuri or a Kyoto exit poll, said they want to see party realignment. They don't like this one party stuff. But they don't like the DPJ either. They want to see some realignment.
As a segue to our other two panelists, I'd like you to talk a little bit about mandate. Did this election create a mandate? And is it commensurate with the sort of balance of power? Does Abe have the votes to push through reforms?
In terms of mandate, the one clear mandate is voters want him to fix the economy, want the government to do stuff about the economy. So the general idea of reviving the economy and the party's message, the LDP's message, was all about that. They didn't talk about these other issues very much, was reforming the economy. However, people are skeptical about whether what the third arrow that others will talk about today really means. And if it means what it should mean, according to economists, which is liberalization, deregulation, basically continuing the Koizumi plan of 10 years ago of cutting off the vested interests, the protected interests in the economy, then he's going to start getting some opposition from within the party, which was Koizumi stood up to. I mean, in a sense, Koizumi was a huge success. He got the major reform that he wanted. He won a big election on the back of his call. But really, if you look at all of the things he wanted to do, not very much of it got done. And then Abe reversed it, not all of the policies, but he let all the postal rebels back in and basically just killed reform, and that's what killed his first administration. There does seem to be some evidence that Abe gets that and that he wants to push forward on this. But if you look at the people who just got elected, how did the LDP win this mandate? They won it by sweeping 29 of the 31 single-member districts, which were all rural. And if you look at the party list, there was a blog post that showed all of the where the people who won via the party list came from. And they were the representatives of all the vested interests. The head of the Postal Union was number one on the LDP's party list, the Postal Workers Union. Representative from Japan Agriculture, doctors, dentists, all of the organized interests that have long supported the LDP were the ones who just got elected to the upper house. So when these folks are presented with a bill, you know, from the government saying let's deregulate your industries, there's going to be some dissension within the party to the point that, you know, it'll be interesting to see how bold the proposals even are. Exit polls and polling before the election show that there's very little support for a lot of the other things that Abe is associated with. Joining the TPP, people are nervous about that. I'll let Medea talk about that. She knows way more than I do. Constitutional reform, people are concerned about that. The consumption tax increase, which is actually got passed by the DPJ administration, although with LDP support. But because Abe came in saying, well, we'll have to think about whether we really want to implement that or maybe postpone it or maybe cancel it, it's now an Abe policy. It's a decision that he's going to have to make. And see, I have the numbers here somewhere. Something like way more than half of Japanese voters at least want the increase in the consumption tax to be postponed. And something like 40% don't want it to happen at all. This is a Yomiuri exit poll. Asking people who said they voted for the LDP, why did you vote for the LDP? 47% said because every other choice is worse. very American. 27% said they did it for a stable government, so that they would have a government that controlled both houses, and they wouldn't have to worry about divided government. 16% said they chose the LDP because of their economic policies, and 10% said for Abe's other political stances. So the mandate is fix the economy, although we're not sure we agree with the way that you're thinking about doing it.
Okay, thanks. Maria, what do you think about this issue of mandate as it concerns economic policy?
Thank you, Richard. I very much agree with what Mike was saying. I think that, you know, we can debate what is going to be the long-term impact of Abenomics. Will it really pay off or not? But I think that regardless of that long-term impact and the debate on that, there has been a very concrete immediate effect, and that is this very handsome electoral victory by the LDP. And I think that, as Mike was describing, the economy has been foremost in the minds of Japanese voters. And, you know, it was, you know, attractive in the sense that the LDP and Prime Minister Abe in particular was offering, you know, hope that actually we can now turn the corner and revitalize the economy. And this sounds better when you look around and look at the other parties and they don't have any proposals concretely as to how they would do this in a different way. So I do think it is a referendum on this focus on the economy, but I'm not sure, and this we get into some of the specifics that Mike was addressing as to whether Prime Minister Abe, through this victory, really has a broad mandate with respect to the economic reform agenda. Let me start highlighting some of the potential issues here. One is, first of all, what you alluded to, the low turnout. That should give us pause before we make the statement that, yes, with this election, the administration received an unconditional broad mandate. Second, I think that it's very clear that in the voter's mind, there is this performance expectation. That is, they'll stay with Abbott, they'll support his administration, provided that the results are forthcoming in the short or medium term. So the idea is that these economic reforms, the benefits of those economic reforms must be felt by the average person in terms of improved employment opportunities, in terms of wage increases, so that the actual person sees an increase in their standard of living. So if it's just going to generate higher corporate profits and so forth, it's not going to be enough for the Japanese population. And I also think it's very important to make this point that I think that the mandate, the popular mandate, is for growth, not necessarily for structural reform. And I think we all understand that they're connected, that if you're going to unleash the productive forces of the Japanese economy, you should indeed tackle these regulatory bottlenecks. But in terms of how the population, the people in Japan, think about what is a proposal from the Abe administration and what they're prepared to support, I think that it's very clear that they have a preference for the stimulus aspect of these proposals and not for the restructuring and reform aspect. So let me give you a number of examples. Agricultural subsidies are popular, but reforms to the land transaction regime, certainly not popular. Subsidies for new capital investments by corporations, popular. But an actual restructuring of corporations to eliminate excessive competition and eliminate some of the market players, certainly not popular. Increased government expending for childcare centers, popular. But deregulating of this important sector, not popular. So I think that we have to make this distinction because there's a disconnect as to how the third arrow is discussed within Japan and outside Japan. Within Japan, as we know, the government labeled this a growth strategy. But when you are outside Japan, I think what people have in mind when they evoke the third arrow is mostly structural reform. And it's important to bear in mind as well that for the LDP, structural reform has certain baggage. And this goes back to the Koizumi era. We must not forget that when the LDP in the past pursued structural reform, it was branded as engaging in market fundamentalism. And this was, you know, a difficult image to fight. And therefore, I don't think there is any appetite in the current administration to be once more branded into that kind of approach. So I think that that's why the stimulus aspect of this is very important, of bringing the whole package and not just talk about the more painful structural reform components.
So it's, from what you say, it sounds like the election is consistent with what I detect to be a lack of enthusiasm about the growth strategy that Abe released about a month ago.
Well, yes, it's true that many people watching developments in Japan were not as enthusiastic. There was some degree of disappointment, especially when they compare this to the first arrow, right? But to be quite fair, Richard, I think it's easier to make a big splash in monetary policy than when you're talking about this more vexing, convoluted, complex process of reconfiguring the way in which the real economy operates. Because I think with monetary policy, it's easier to make a bold move that sends instantly a signal to markets that the government is going to now take a very different direction. And therefore, people refer to Mr. Kuroda's bazooka, right, when he actually talked about doubling the monetary supply, targeting a 2% inflation rate. And that actually created, you know, people were very much impressed with that. It was an instant message that could be very effectively communicated. But when you're talking about the third arrow, the growth strategy, the structural reform, we're talking about very different set of policy issues all bundled together that are going to involve many more interests, many more bureaucracies, and the time of implementation is going to be much longer. So, you know, just to summarize, because I'm not sure how many people in the audience are familiar with what are the different components of this growth strategy, it has three basic pillars. The first one is the revitalization of industry. And here the idea is that the government wants to promote, encourage capital investments from industry. He's talking about promoting mergers and acquisitions. He's trying to now create conditions whereby venture capital can prosper in Japan. And, of course, regulatory reform, where there is a very, very ambitious proposal to reform the electricity sector. And that actually is going to be a key proposal to keep an eye on. So that's one pillar. Then you also have the second pillar, which is nurture human capital. And here are very attractive ideas like promoting working women, which will require, of course, a big expansion in childcare services in Japan, more flexible working schedules. There's also this idea that the government should try to subsidize new hires as opposed to give subsidies for enterprises to maintain redundant employees, to have a higher level in terms of the universities being more globalized, being able to generate greater knowledge. There's also all these emphases on the education system and that many Japanese students should travel overseas and learn English. And the third component is the new market creation. And I think here are some very interesting ideas. One of them is, for example, that you should turn Japan's weaknesses into Japan's strengths. So if we know that Japan faces significant challenges demographically with aging of the population, well, that could be an opportunity for Japan to become a leader in providing top-quality healthcare services for the elderly that could then be emulated abroad. There's also this component of integration into the global economy, trying to encourage now very seriously foreign direct investment in Japan and signing on ambitious trade agreements. So it is mind-boggling, if you think about it, all the different areas that this growth strategy is trying to address. And I think, therefore, it's very difficult to have that bazooka, that, you know, a very concise, effective message that tells people we are very serious and this is what we're doing differently. But, you know, so we have to acknowledge that. But it's true also, the way I see this growth strategy as released in June, there are a number of issues that need to be worked on. We have very ambitious targets. There is talk about Japan having a real rate of growth of 2% on average for the next 10 years. There is talk about doubling the stock of foreign direct investment in Japan. There is talk about doubling farming income and doubling seem to be popular, and doubling agricultural exports. But what is less clear, of course, is the specific steps to get us there. But I think we should be waiting for that more detailed strategy on these different sectors. And I think it's also true that in some areas the reform did not go far enough. Some very important and critical issues were left out. Genuine measures that could actually create labor market flexibility in Japan were not yet forthcoming. The business sector was disappointed with the fact that the corporate tax rate was not lowered. And there are some very important deregulation measures in the medical sector that are still very much needed in the so-called mixed treatment. So I see this. For me, the June growth strategy is the first installment. It is a step in the right direction. It doesn't yet go all the way. It doesn't yet all give us all the concrete steps. But we also have to understand how remarkable it is that the government releases a growth strategy that has an important regulatory component on the eve of an important election. And therefore, I think that we need to understand, and we have perhaps to be a little patient, that this is installment one, trying to break away from these political constraints that have hindered so much the policy-making process in Japan. And really, the heavy lifting starts from now on. And I think, therefore, we need to be watching to see if there is going to then be the much-needed filling in the gaps and tackling the more needed issues.
With respect to the agriculture part of the growth strategy, do you think the election in any way changed the politics of agriculture policy?
Yes.
And including market opening measures?
Yes. I think in some important ways it did. As you all know, agricultural reform has been one of the most vexing political problems in Japan. The agricultural sector in Japan has been suffering a decline for many years, and it has been difficult for Japan to really punch at a level it should be punching in international trade negotiations because of these difficulties with the resistance from the agricultural sector. It has been the Achilles heel of Japanese trade policy. Now, I think that the elections themselves have an important message regarding what is forthcoming in terms of agricultural politics and in terms of Japan's trade strategy. I think that it's very important to first of all note that there was no rural backlash against the LDP, even though for the first time you have now Japan joining an unprecedented trade negotiation in terms of its level of ambition, right? Remember that the TPP sets a very high bar in terms of how substantive the liberalization target should be. In principle, no exceptions, but certainly something around 98% of tariff elimination is very much within the LDP level, the TPP, not the LDP, the TPP level of ambition. So I think that, you know, it is sets a very important precedent that you have a government that makes the commitment to take Japan to a trade negotiation and it can actually win handsomely an election. I remember I was just like Mike. I didn't do the right forecast. I remember at the beginning of this year when they were asking us, now that the LDP is in power, what are the prospects of quickly joining the TPP? And most of us were not actually expecting Mr. Abe to move so quickly on this because we knew how important it was to cement, to consolidate its hold over the upper house. And joining the TPP could actually be quite disruptive, and therefore the expectation was that he wouldn't do it. We know also that within the LDP, there are still many politicians with strong ties to agriculture, and mainly that, therefore, were very much very skeptical of the notion of joining the TPP. But I think that the fact that he decided to move quickly and still won this election, and especially on that a group of swing districts that are very rural, where, you know, he actually, the LDP creamed, right, of 31, the LDP got 29. That's a very positive signal for the future of perhaps, you know, moving further with agricultural liberalization. Does this mean that the TPP negotiations and agriculture are going to be a piece of cake? Certainly not. This is going to be an arduous battle that needs to be fought. Because, you know, the LDP, I think, was very savvy in the way in which it approached the election. Sure, the commitment on the TPP, this is very important. But then it set aside what it calls the sanctuary commodities, those commodities that cannot be touched. There are five of those, rice, sugar, beef, wheat, and dairy, right? And therefore, the idea is that the message that the party was sending to supporters is that we're going to fight for those commodities. There can be no liberalization there. And at the same time, you have the public works, the fiscal, the second arrow pumping in, and the promise for greater subsidies, not less. So again, it was this very savvy combination, I think, of some bitter medicine to swallow, but also some goodies provided. Now, I think that, you know, what we're now going to witness moving forward is how is the government going to reconcile between the LDP's position of the sanctuary five commodities and the expectation from TPP partners that that's not acceptable, that Japan needs to go forward. And I think creative thinking is going to be required. There are many things that can be done. Certainly, you know, for example, even within rice, it's possible to liberalize those tariff lines that are about rice that is used for processing, for senbei, for Japanese crackers. And you're going to talk about longer phasing periods for the tariffs. And you're certainly going to have to do other things that I can discuss later to try to address the sources of low productivity and lack of international competitiveness. It's going to become imperative to do this.
Okay.
Could I jump in on?
Sure, please.
Something Maria said was about the election was particularly fascinating. She's exactly right. The vagaries of publishing dictate that something that I wrote in January, it's coming out, I think, this week, says, one thing we know for sure is Abe will not move on TPP before the upper house election. Sorry, now you're wondering why I was invited here.
You didn't tell us that before.
there was one sense in which what he did, I think, did not contradict that. But another in which I think he was considerably more farsighted. The way it didn't contradict is exactly what Maria just said, that he said, okay, we're going to join the TPP, but we're going to protect these important agricultural sectors, which shouldn't be allowed in the TPP. It's supposed to be all-in type of thing, and people bought that for a few months. And also, on the other hand, saying, you know, whatever it is that's going to happen with the TPP, which, you know, once we join, we'll be a little bit out of our control, we'll fight, is, well, lots of subsidies, lots of public works, so we're going to take away with one hand and give with the other, right? But the way in which he was more farsighted than analysts were, I think, is the way Mireya just said it was there was no rural backlash against his announcement on TPP. I think what's happened with the demise of the DPJ, because remember the reason the DPJ first took away the upper house in 07 was Ozawa Ichiro was their lead strategist, and he basically out-LDP'd the LDP in the rural districts and said, look what Koizumi did with the postal workers. He abandoned you. You can't trust the LDP anymore. Come to us and we'll help you out. Well, that was 2007. The rural areas no longer believe the DPJ has their interests at heart or any ability to get anything done. And so whereas for 40 years the agricultural sector had the LDP captured, now it looks like it's the other way around. And the LDP calculated that rural voters had nowhere else to go. That there was, and I didn't have time to check because the data came out just as I was getting on the plane, to see if turnout, if there were turnout effects in the rural areas, if the way that the rural voters objected was not by voting for anyone else, who would they vote for, but by staying home in greater numbers than, say, people in other parts of the country. But basically, they had nowhere else to go. So Abe calculated that this kind of half-in TPP strategy would be enough to please urban voters, annoy but not really completely infuriate rural voters, and really, where were the rural voters going to go? The urban voters had options.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's switch to security and international politics and to Mike Mochizuki. Mike, there are a number of issues that have been waiting for this election to happen before we can address them, or depended on the outcome of the election to sort of set the parameters. I'm thinking of Article 9, remilitarization, whatever that means, defense cooperation with the United States, Futenma, reinterpretation of the Constitution when it comes to defense issues. What's changed, and what can we expect?
Great. Well, first of all, I've got a saying by a prominent conservative politician from the 1950s, I believe it's by Miki Bukuchi, who says, in politics, 1 inch ahead is pure darkness. And I've been burned many times by making bad predictions, especially about Mr. Abe. But I think, before I get to these very important issues, I agree completely with what Mike and Mireya has been saying about the softness of LDP support and support for Abe himself and the complicated nature of the electoral mandate. But I think when we step back, we have to remember this has been one of the greatest political comebacks in Japanese political history. And who would have thought after Mr. Abe resigned and pretty much disgraced that he would be back here again? And secondly, he could enter into this very rare pantheon of Japanese prime ministers who have served more 4 years or more, which is an amazing thing. In post-war Japan, I think it's only five prime ministers that have served in office 4 years or more. And what's more, given what we've heard about the disarray of the opposition party, even with his difficult agenda, it's quite possible that in the next election, which doesn't have to be called until 3 years from now, in the next pair of elections, the upper house and the lower house election, that, if he does okay, he could still win. And if that happens, he could go down in history as being the prime minister with the longest time in office. And so, I think that despite all the problems, one really needs to think seriously about where Mr. Abe might take Japan. And certainly, although he's gotten the message of Bill Clinton that it's the economy, it's stupid, I think it's in his political DNA that he wants to change Japanese national identity. He wants to change Japan's perspective on defense policy. And I think he would like to go down in history as the first Japanese prime minister who changed the post-war constitution. Now, that's a very ambitious agenda. He may have quite a bit of time to do this. Now, he's going to have to worry about the economy, but he might incrementally push on that front. And he's helped in some ways. China's helping Mr. Abe. Every time Chinese marine surveillance vessels intrude into the territorial waters of the Senkakus, Japanese, they may be pacifists, but they are very irritated by Chinese behavior. And so although there is not a clear political mandate for what some might call the remilitarization of Japan, and I don't like that term at all. There is enough support so that Mr. Abe can push the envelope a little bit more on a variety of defense issues. And one, of course, is kind of filling out, fleshing out the new concept of a dynamic defense force so that Japan can deploy forces rapidly to deal with some contingency involving the defense of the Southwest Island chain. And there's going to be a new National Defense Program guideline that will be unveiled. I think the interim report just came out. And one of the key things in this is the creation of a Marine Corps-type amphibious unit that is rapidly deployable. Also, he's already reversed an 11-year trend of reducing the absolute funding for defense. Now, this does not mean that Japan is then going to go way beyond 1% of GDP in terms of defense spending, but at least he has reversed the tide. He will also pursue a new guideline for defense cooperation between the United States and Japan. The last time the guidelines were changed, that was in 1997, the major issue at that time was the threat from North Korea. That threat is still there, but the world has changed dramatically. China has become a major military power in the region. It is becoming more assertive. And so although the new defense cooperation guidelines should not be all about China, it will be a lot about China. And in an era of cybersecurity, space security issues, the distinction that was in the 1997 defense cooperation guidelines, the distinction between kind of rear area support and the front area, I think that is no longer tenable. So I think Mr. Abe will push on that front. But he will be constrained, and part of it has to do with fiscal constraints. Secondly, the constraints of kind of the resilience of anti-military attitudes. He's going to be constrained by the Komeito. The Komeito is really necessary to sustain the electoral base of the LDP. But the Komeito sees itself as a restraint on some of these defense issues. I mean, this is already beginning to happen. One of the issues in the interim report for the National Defense Program guideline is the issue of whether Japan should acquire the capability to attack an enemy or a base or an adversary base, a missile base that might be threatening to Japan. And there are many conservatives who think, of course, this is right within the right of individual self-defense. Well, it seems that the Komeito is putting the brakes on that. So Abe, you know, has an ambitious agenda in terms of defense, but he does face constraints, but at the same time, he may have quite a bit of time, and the more China is assertive, then that gives him some political support for that. Now, in terms of the Constitution, some of the public opinion polls taken soon after the election reported that only about 4% of the Japanese public wants Abe to focus on constitutional revision. Now, what's puzzling is that the Asahi Shimbun, which has not been known for promoting constitutional revision, reported that I think 75% of those elected for the upper house were for constitutional revision. And now you might have a two-thirds majority in both houses of parliament in favor of constitutional revision. So if you think that, you will think, well, constitutional revision is going to happen. But the limitation of that public opinion poll is that it really did not get into what kind of constitutional revision. And it seems that the Japanese people and maybe even many politicians are not sure that they want to change the Constitution in a way so that Japan moves essentially from kind of what they call a peace-loving country. So I think Mr. Abe wants to certainly provoke a constitutional debate, but he's not going to be able to revise the Constitution. So what will happen in the meantime is, I think, a reinterpretation of the Constitution so Japan can exercise its right of individual and collective self-defense. And this could happen simply through a cabinet decision. Now, there may be some blowback after that, but I think that's foremost on the agenda. Now, of course, I can talk about Okinawa if you want me to. But
let's let somebody provoke you.
Right.
In terms of foreign policy, do you think that Abe will make a sincere and deliberate effort to repair relations with the Republic of Korea and China? Is he going to stick with the pre-election approach to historical memory or shift?
Well, on China, I don't see him making very many major moves. I think his strategy is basically to show firmness on the sovereignty issue, to counter the intrusions, but show restraint in terms of deploying personnel or making new, constructing new things on the Senkaku Islands, and leave it to the Chinese to then escalate. And then if that were to happen, the expectation is that world opinion would be on Japan's side. So although he's talked about having a willingness to have a summit meeting, I think he's not going to be very conciliatory towards the Chinese. On Korea, you know, I personally think it is in Japan's strategic interest to repair the damage with Korea. Whether or not Mr. Abe goes with his political DNA or thinks strategically, it's really up to him. But I think some of the statements that he made before the election were counterproductive. I do recognize that he exercised some restraints, so he did not ignite a full-blown memory war with Korea, but he came awfully close. And, you know, there are some people who say that Prime Minister Abe at some point will...